The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Laurie Wright from Southampton Solent University as part of our mini-series on climate action in response to the UN Climate Change Conference. Today's episode is hosted by Sunny Tierney. Hello, how are you today, Dr. Laurie Wright?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Sunny. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast. It's great to be here.
That's all right. I'm glad to have you. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So I'm an associate professor at Solent University and I'm director of the Centre for Marine Sustainability. And I also look after all of our environment engineering research at the uni. By my background, I suppose, is as an environmental scientist. So I spent much of my career, telling people about the disasters that are facing us in sustainability and then trying to perhaps suggest ways we might fix and avoid some of those major problems that are coming down the pipeline.
Cool, that's really good. So you're part of a few organisations, such as being a member on the Forum for Sustainability through Life Cycle Innovation and the co-chair of the American Center for Life Assessment. Could you expand on first what these organizations do and also what life cycle innovation is?
Yeah, so both the organizations are international organizations that, as you said, deal with either life cycle innovation or life cycle assessment. So I've been with the American Center for Life Cycle Assessment, the ACLCA, for a number of years, since 12, I think, I first came into contact with them. And they exist as an organization to promote the use of life cycle assessment as a method, sustainability assessment. Now, probably worth me sort of explaining what that means. So when we talk about life cycles in environmental science, what we're talking about is the a bit like a life cycle of an organism. So if you think about a caterpillar, it's born as a caterpillar, it spends a few days eating and goes into pupae, emerges as a butterfly, then carries on. And it goes through a life cycle through these various stages. Now, products, they go through similar stages. So from the point, so we took something like a plastic bottle, for example. Starts as oil, processed into various chemical compounds, which are then broken down into plastics. We use the plastic and then we throw it away. So it has these distinct life stages. So that's what life cycle means in this context. And then the assessment bit is us really applying modeling and numbers to understand the impact that has on our environment out in the world. So that's life cycle assessment. Now, FSLCI, which is the Forum for Sustainability through Life Cycle Innovation, similar, based out of Berlin, international organization, again, promoting that same method and that same technique. And it's really a technique that I believe gets to the heart of a lot of our sustainability issues and allows us to really address them on a level that actually makes change and impact based in science.
Definitely. Okay, well, that sounds really interesting. So I also read that you're interested in investigating and reducing the environmental impacts from the maritime industry. Could you tell us about the kind of environmental impacts that are coming from that industry?
Yeah, so one of the particular focuses we have in the centre is on the maritime industry, and this really ties in with Solent's history with the maritime industry. We've got well in excess of 50 plus years of working with shipping companies and port operators and you name it in the maritime industry, we've worked with them. So I think it's worth understanding first the scale of what's going on here a little bit, that if your listeners were to look around the room that they're sat in right now, pretty much everything that you look at least part of it, if not all of it, will have been on a ship at some point in its life. Over 80% of all our traded goods travel by ship. So it's a vast, vast industry. The problem that comes with that is about 3% of all global greenhouse gas emissions come from these ships. So it's if you put it in a country scale, that's bigger than Germany. It's bigger than Brazil. It's about the sixth biggest, if it were a country, in the world. So pretty major problem in something that is otherwise quite invisible. We don't really think about it. And it presents a number of challenges because these ships, they're at sea potentially for months at a time. Largely, as I said, going unnoticed. So we're working on ways to try and reduce that carbon burden. And it's got to be done in the context that we can't simply switch the ships off, that we still need that trade pipeline. So the things we're looking at are things like alternative fueling systems. So that's everything from hydrogen to methanol, ammonia, even as far as nuclear. So it's all about trying to reduce that impact. And beyond the greenhouse gas issues, there's a number of other issues around other pollutants. So things like sulfur-based pollutants or nitrous pollutants, which are particularly bad for human health. Also things like particulate matter. So we do think of things like soot, really, but they're very, very, very fine particulates. So things that are what we would refer to as a PM2.5. So that refers to it being smaller than 2.5 micrometers in diameter. So if you think of a strand of your hair, that's 70 micrometers. So it's significantly smaller than a piece of your hair. And these particles are small enough that they would get into your lungs, they could pass straight into your bloodstream. So they're again, pretty damaging for human health. So what we're looking at is ways we can reduce right across the board. So greenhouse gases first, and then has knock-on effects to other pollutants as well.
Wow, that is a... That's amazing, like not amazing, but that is that's not something that I really knew much about. Like maritime industry in general isn't something that I'm all that familiar with, but I also never really knew that it had that kind of environmental impact. And I think it is really easy to glaze over it because it's not something that we see every day. So it ends up getting pushed to the side in comparison to a lot of other environmental issues.
I think that's if I may, that's kind of the problem with it. I think it is pretty much invisible, and there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people working in this industry that are also pretty much invisible when you really don't think about it. With Christmas coming up, very few of us will walk into a shop and wonder where our products might have come from. We might look at a label and it says made in China or something like that on the label. But how it got here, I don't think we think about that. It would have set sail a couple of months ago and made its way around the world potentially. So it just is that thing that, before I started working in this field in particular, I didn't really think about it. It is just an incredible industry. It's just huge in the scale of things. And even when we think about just one of the ships, if you get the chance to ever go down to the dockside and locally for us in Southampton, these things are enormous, just incredible feats of engineering. They are just absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. So as well as that, when you consider that the maritime industry is already having that effect on all of the planet, how specifically is that having an effect on the oceans that they're traveling in?
There's a number of effects actually you're seeing. So if we consider the climate, the oceans make up about two-thirds of our planet, and since 1950 they've warmed by nearly a degree's worth of temperature. So there's significant warming in the ocean, and the majority of the warming we talk about when we talk been in the oceans, and that's a function of greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, hexafluoride. There's a number of them that contribute. But I think, again, it's useful to sort of think about this in context. And a degree doesn't sound like a lot, but when you consider the sheer scale of the oceans, if you think about your home kettle and you switch your kettle on, if you ever sat and you've watched the little electric meter go when you've put your kettle on, and it goes quite mad because you're talking kilowatt plus of energy. Water needs a lot of energy to heat up. So that degree in the sea, it's equivalent to about 5 Hiroshima bombs worth of energy every single second being put into the oceans. So it's a massive, massive amount of energy. And the effect of that is that huge amount of energy then is put into the climate system. So it's the climate and the atmosphere that are causing our weather patterns and our climatic patterns. So that extra energy is then leading to storm frequency, more tent storms, all these kind of things we talk about in the field. So one of the major effects is through that, through the greenhouse gas emission that comes from these vessels. Other impacts that you see from shipping, things like there was historically really now not so much of a problem these days, but things like ballast water transfer. So we talk about things like invasives. So ships take on ballast water to balance, offload cargo. And there's always a risk of transfer of one creature or plant from one area to another. So example of something. One that's jumping to mind is Japanese knotweed, but it's actually a land-based problem. But it's an invasive species, and I think we're all familiar with it, that it can destroy the value of your house. It's non-native. So those implications are huge. But there's a number of national and international agreements that try and prevent that, and technologies that try and prevent it. You're also seeing additional sort of a pollutant type emissions. We're mentioning things like sulfur and nitrogens and things like that. That can lead to acid formation in the atmosphere. So we get a knock-on effect from that as well. But there's a whole range of things that are tied to these big industries. And it's like any major industry that's burning fossil fuels, really, that you're going to have significant environmental consequences as a result.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just sort of becoming aware to me that just how big of an issue this area is. I mean, I think it's definitely pushed to the side for a lot of the other issues. And even when we do talk about the maritime industry, I only ever really hear about sort of like fishing issues and like oil spills and that sort of thing. So that's mainly the kind of thing that I hear about when it comes to problems with the ocean, when that issue is just like quite small in comparison to these issues.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really touched on fishing. I mean, fishing's a whole other industry, and I think it's a kind of classical environmental problem that's taught to every single environmental sciences student I ever teach. We talk about the sort of the collapse of North Sea cod or something as an example of that. And it's another issue that's facing the sea. Half the world's population now are living in coastal areas, with millions of those people relying on the sea. Millions more rely on the seas for food, as you talk about fishing. And the issues from something like North Sea cod arise from our overuse of cod as a resource. We took out too many individuals, and then they couldn't breed, and the population collapsed. It's good to say that that's reversing now. We're seeing that as quite a positive, but we're still seeing similar practices, massive factory ships that are scouring unselectively across our oceans. And it's an ongoing issue, if you will. It really comes down to being more responsible, I think, as a collective race of humans, being a little bit more responsible with the way we use resources and the way we respect them as well.
Absolutely. I think that is like a major issue that is all across the board, really, is just our method of just consuming and using so many resources that we don't need to use. And it is a problem, and it's becoming worse and worse as we go on, and especially having big factories that are mass producing all of these products that aren't going to get used or are going to get thrown away. It's having a drastic effect on every part of our planet.
Yeah, and I think we're probably quite timely that we're four days away from Black Friday now, so yeah. Mass consumerist event. I think you risk as a scientist becoming a kind of bit preachy when you start saying stop using less stuff, but fundamentally the way we use stuff is part of the problem. We talked about plastic bottles earlier, and you take plastic as a material. It's quite amazing, actually, as an engineering material. It's fantastic. You can think of all the medical advances that have happened as a result of plastic invention, military technologies that have happened, computing technologies, electric, all of these things that happened because of plastics. And one of the amazing qualities of it is it doesn't degrade. It lasts hundreds of years, potentially. we make plastic bottles out of polyethylene terephthalate, so PET. 450 years, quite easily. That'll stick around long, long after we're gone. But then we use it once for about 10 minutes at most, if you drink your bottle of drink slowly, and then you throw it away. And it's a fundamental rethink in the way we're actually using that material that's required. It's not the plastic that's the problem. It's the behavior and the way we use it that is causing significant issues. So I think it's very easy to just to point our finger and say, well, we all use too much stuff in society, but it's the way we use that stuff, an issue and a problem.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, that is, like, when it comes to plastic, it is kind of frustrating that we've created this material that is so, like, it lives such a long time. And the way that we utilize that is to make it, you know, one use and disposable. And it's just frustrating that that is also having, like, a massive effect on our oceans and landfill and everything in the way that we produce it. And you would have thought that when we created this product that we would find a way that to use it more innovatively, like taking into account how long it lives and using that for that purpose instead.
I suppose nobody sets out, do they, to destroy the world. I think that's the Manhattan Project, Oppenheimer, never set out to quote as he did, it's becoming the destroyer of worlds. And it's that similar thing. I think we invent and create and make this stuff not with the purpose of damage in mind, but of the purpose of innovation. And plastics really sort of came onto the scene probably about the 1950s. There were plastics before that, things like Bakelite and stuff, but the true plastics we know were around the 1950s, post-war. A lot of them had been invented during the war as massive innovations that were happening at the time. And I think it was just so exciting. I think that's the thing with it. And actually, you can do so much more with plastics that you couldn't do with other materials. So you think about something like aluminium or steel or something, you can't use it in the same way. It doesn't have that same property. It's not, it doesn't have that flexibility, the clarity you can with plastic, the colors, the moldability, you know, the lightness, all of these qualities is what makes it so incredible. But then we like we said, you use it in a bizarre way. Yeah. When you consider how many billions of bottles are being produced every single year, and then that, as you said, having an impact on the oceans again, because majority of those plastics, no matter how goodwill intentioned we are with it when we try and end its life, majority of it still ends up in the sea, escapes from landfill, or it just escapes onto land and it finds its way into rivers tend to lead to the sea, so that's where it ends up, and it'll stay there for years. And I think the reality is we don't yet fully understand the consequences. There's still a lot of questions that are being asked. We've all seen pictures of things like albatross chicks eating small bits of plastic and then they starve to death, and that's one bit. We know that, we can see that, but plastics that sit in the deep ocean in the sediments, we're not sure what's going to happen to those. The microplastics that are in the sea, again, we're not 100% what's going to happen there. So it's potentially quite a major problem that's sitting on the horizon waiting for us. I was reading the other day, hearing it compared to asbestos, you know, that idea of microplastics that we're all potentially ingesting, but don't know the consequences of what that's going to be yet. And it's not about scaring people, that's not what it's about, but we don't know. We simply don't know what the consequence. It could be nothing. It could be completely benign, but it might not be.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just as you were saying that, I was thinking about the deep ocean and how much to the floor that we can't access, and thinking about just how much plastic and litter might be building up there, which is just a horrible thought, really, and how that's having an effect on those deep sea creatures as well. So moving on, otherwise we might stay in this topic all day. So as well as within the maritime industry, you used to teach about carbon management at University of Southampton. What are the biggest carbon emitters that we're struggling to reduce?
So I was in a different life, a teaching fellow up at the University of Southampton. And as you say, teaching in carbon management. So there's a number, and I think there's the classical ones. There's the heavy industry. And that's by definition, if we look down at Southampton Water, again, local to us, there's some pretty heavy industry along the sides there, and that's a major carbon source. We've already mentioned shipping, other transport things like aviation, our cars is a major source. But if we look a bit more closely, if we sort of zoom in on the UK, there's things like domestic energy. It's a huge, huge source of carbon. And actually most of that energy is coming through heating, space heating in our houses, the energy that we put in. So we tend to use things like gas boilers. I know it's been all over the news recently, but we are using vast amounts of energy to heat our homes. Collectively, that makes up a large proportion of our emissions.
I didn't realize that specifically was such a big carbon emitter, especially because I've literally just put the heating on because I'm really cold in my house. What can we do to avoid that? What are our alternatives that we can use that aren't emitting so much carbon but are still doing the job that they're meant to?
If you take it at the really big scale, at the global scale, one of the biggest sources is energy. And everything we're doing requires energy, and primarily that energy still comes from fossil fuels, and that makes up vast amounts of carbon as we break that fuel down and then break the energy off it. So at that global level, it's about a shift to below zero energy generation sources. But that's not great when you're sat there as an individual trying to think, what can I do? Because that's very much out of your scope of ability to do anything, really. Mm-hmm. Let's take the heating argument as a run for the moment. And most of us are probably using a gas boiler. Some of us might have heat pumps in our homes at the moment. Heat pumps, been all over the news. They are much, much lower carbon. If you're drawing off the grid, we have quite a high level of renewables on the UK grid. So it's a good way of reducing your carbon, but it's not suitable for everybody. I think that's what's kind of been misconstrued in the news at the moment with the announcement from government of their incentives that are coming out in April. And it's not sort of a wonder bullet that's going to fix the one of the first things you really ought to be doing is actually trying to simply reduce energy use. Think about a house, and if a house, for example, I live in an old, probably about 300-year-old house. It's listed. I can't do a huge amount to it. So I have a single brick wall on what part of the house. That part of the house will be leaking energy out, and I'll be heating, but that energy is escaping. So the first thing we really need to do is try and reduce that loss of energy. Because if you imagine half of what you're generating just is wasted. And it's like we were saying about the sort of single-use plastic. You're just generating something simply to throw it away. So capture that, insulate number one. That's the first thing to do. So you're actually reducing the loss. And that has a cost benefit as well. So homeowner, of course, if you can insulate, reduce your costs for your heating. So you actually And then once you've done that, it's time to start thinking about how can I actually transition and start to move something else. And that might be a heat pump. It could be the future hydrogen's being spoken about. It could be all manner of things. But first point, reduce the loss, reduce the waste.
Okay, that's really interesting. So you also wrote an article about the future of climate change if robots continue to take over our job industry, and how, while at first it might appear more sustainable and efficient, it could end up leading to more problems in the future. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so this was a piece I wrote for The Conversation, I think, and what we were gaming out, I suppose, in our article was we're in the middle of what's being described as the fourth industrial revolution. We're going through a major change in our industry, and that's the transition to artificial intelligence, big data, robotics, all of these new techs that are massively disrupting our lives right now. And robotics is not a new thing. We've used robots on production lines for years, but it's the nature of the robotics. And you look at like Boston Dynamics and the advancements in robotics that we've been seeing with these kind of companies. It's not unreasonable to think that robots will take more and more of the menial tasks that previously have been done by humans. And it's not really different from previous industrial revolutions. If you think about the process that happened, that we mechanized, that then removed people from the fields and life changed and shifted. What we might see, though, is as more things are done robotically, we can do them more efficiently and cheaper, quicker. That potentially could reduce impact. So we have less energy, less material going into process, much more efficient process. And if we continue to kind of consume as the rate we're consuming, then actually you'll probably see a reduction. But there's also a kind of flip side to this. One is potentially using more energy because you're building a more intensive supply chain. And it also becomes, because the system becomes more efficient, we produce more stuff and then we start to consume more stuff. So then the overall emissions will go up as a result of us consuming more cheap stuff. So it's one of those double-edged swords, if you want to use a bit of a cliche there, but it could really help us, the technology. And I'm a firm believer that technology is one of the ways out of the crisis, right? But it's got to, again, be done in a way that it doesn't create damage and it doesn't actually exacerbate and worsen the problem. Sort of, putting this stuff is just simply making us consume more disposable plastic stuff.
Definitely. So it all comes back to mass consumption again. The idea that we're just pumping out all of these products that we can't really keep up with the demand for. And a lot of that is just end up going to waste. So we're putting a lot of energy and time and work that's going into creating these machines and robots that are doing these jobs, and then we're looking at this product and then being like, no, not for me. I think it's also something to consider how that's having an effect on the job industry as well. The more that we create these easier ways to manufacture things, the less jobs we're creating for people or taking away from people, which is making people poorer and meaning that they aren't able to consume as much. So it's all having an effect on one another and going around in a sort of cycle, isn't it?
I think that's very true. So there's the immediate shift that you may see people, traditional jobs disappearing. The heavy manufacturing type jobs probably will disappear. Even jobs in the construction industry, we're seeing the advent of things like printable buildings now, which is amazing technology, but it is going to have consequences for people's jobs. There is a sort of a school of thought, I suppose, that actually it depends what you define by wealth, in that, but monetarily, yes, there's a consequence to this. And I think in that aspect, society will evolve, new jobs will appear. And they did in the past, that people were fearful of the loss of agricultural jobs in earlier industrial revolutions, but new jobs came along, new careers were created, new technologies we didn't even know about, that void. But what it potentially has, this advent, is the ability to free us and give us yet more time to interests that perhaps we wouldn't have done otherwise, you know. So I think it's something really, really simple. You think about the washing machine and the way the washing machine changes society, that it freed up hours of our time to do other things. And the same, I think, could happen as a result of the changes we're seeing at the moment. But I think you're right. You've got to manage it in the right way, that it doesn't have mass economic consequences and leave people behind, because otherwise you end up with people who have no access to employment. And you've got to think through those. And that may have knock-on consequences for rethinking economic models or societal models as well. So it's quite a wide-ranging shift, you're going to say.
Definitely. I think it's also something to consider that while definitely there will be more jobs created and, you know, I mean, like new career paths will emerge from those old ones disappearing. But the problem is the waiting period in between, and those people who would have had those manufacturing jobs or other jobs of that similar nature that are now being replaced, is that they are having to wait until these new jobs come in. And that's that, you know, that could be months, that could be years. It's a difficult process that is very much like undefined and completely like spontaneous. So for people in that sort of, you know, wealth gap, that is like the main issue that I'm sort of talking about here, is that that effect on people of that wealth disparity is not something that is being noticed or accounted for. And I mean, feel like I'm constantly looking for jobs and not really finding anything. And, you know, I'm in like a media position, which is one of the positions that has got, you know, quite a lot of positions available, and I'm still struggling. So being in that sort of position where the things that you were trained for, the things that you've been doing for years and years and years, and then having that taken away from you is just difficult to cope with, really.
Yeah, I think there's a real risk actually here of seeing that grow. And it, again, we need to learn from history. The shift in car manufacturing in Detroit is an example, and the collapse of thousands of jobs in a city that's pretty much on its knees, really. But if it's mismanaged, you know, we don't have to look far for the consequence, do we? So, but it is, I think, a sort of a shift in our mode of thinking, a shift in our kind of societal understanding and our economic understanding, that perhaps the current economic model isn't what we'll see in 10 years' time. It may be something very different. You know, there's a lot of talk on all sides of the political spectrum around things like UBI, universal basic, as a concept. You know, that could be something that came in. It could be something even more radical, you know. But I think you're dead right that if we don't think through those consequences, then we are going to see swathes of people. One thing I would say, though, to your feeling looking for jobs, I would never have put myself where I am now 10, 15 years ago when I first set on this footprint. And yeah, I would never have put myself as an academic, let alone be a professor, you know, when I was at school or anything like that. And it's one of those things, I think sometimes things come from weird angles that you were never expecting, you know. And that, I think, should give us a bit of hope, because there's other things out there that we haven't even imagined yet. Jobs that in 10 years' time we can't imagine yet, because we don't know what technology is going to be like. We don't know what society is going to be like. And yeah, so there's always a positive to it, but it does have to be thought about properly now. And I do, you know, worry a bit that's not being considered really at the highest of levels. It's not being thought about, and we're walking into this massive change without considering what the consequences might be, like you said, on people's lives and people's jobs.
It is just an effect that is definitely going to take its toll if we don't consider the options.
Yeah.
So I've got one more question for you today. So we are recording this episode after the COP26 event, but this is our question of the season. So I'm going to ask you anyway. If you could say anything to the world leaders, talk to them about any of the issues that we might have talked about today or anything else, what would you say? What would you want to tell them?
Good question. It's a really good question. It's easy. I think your mind suddenly jumps, doesn't it, when you ask that kind of question. The words of someone like David Attenborough or something, born with hope, not fear, you know, these, or maybe a quote as Boris did, Kermit the Frog. I think, you know, I've probably been doing this for 15 years or so as a job, a career. Before that, I was a student studying it. What I was studying 20 years ago has now happened. And didn't at the time, it wasn't predicted to happen within that space. And 2020 was always a date that was held up as this watershed moment somehow, that things such as the Rio conventions that happened in 1990 would suddenly somehow come to fruition. We'd see this change, this shift. And of course, it didn't happen. We are still reliant on million-year-old fossil energy that we dig up and burn. And that technology, frankly, is the same technology we had when we were living in caves. Fire burning energy, and there are alternatives. They are right in front of us, and we can, with the right political will, get hold of them and do something about it. And that's really where the problem is. It's not that we can't, it's that we're choosing not to. You just have to look at the shift, for example, in the American economy when America entered the war. There are stories of whole factory floors and car factories being demolished by guys with jackhammers, ripping machinery out the floor to install manufacturing equipment for the war machine that was built. And it happened in weeks. You know? And that, if the political will is there, we can do something. And if I might sort of indulge myself with a quote, you know, Rachel Carson, an author of a book called Silent Spring back in the 60s, and she really did change the whole narrative of environmentalism. So she was writing about DDT, which is a pesticide, and the consequences that had. But she left a quote, which is that we're challenged not only to be masters, not of nature, but of ourselves. And actually, I think that really sticks to me, is this idea that it's not, we don't need to master nature. Nature's done that on its own for millions of years. What we need to do is master our own behaviours and our own responsibilities. And that is what will lead to significant change.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been really enlightening, and I feel like I've learned so much just from this conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close the interview?
Well, just to thank you, Sunny, for inviting me on. It's a real pleasure to be here chatting with you today. And just, yeah, I think, keep the pressure on, because that's what's important. We need to make the changes, and the changes are there right in front of us that we can all take action now.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you very much for coming on.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Dr. Laurie Wright. Hosted by Sunny Tierney. Organised by Sunny Tierney. Music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainablelivingorg. Thank you for listening.